and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is Carbajal against Household Bank. Mr. Langone.
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent Roy Carbajal in this appeal. We were before this court 2 years ago attempting to extricate ourselves from a settlement that we did not negotiate, that we did not participate in, and that we did not agree to, one that released all of the claims of Mr. Carbajal and the putative class that he seeks to represent for $25. Mr. Carbajal's claims were, in our view, worth substantially more than $25, not only because his actual damages were over $3,000, the amount of the tax refund that we contend was illegally intercepted, but there were also statutory damages available to him under federal law. When we were last before this court, defendants did not take the position that the case should go to arbitration. Defendants took the position that the case should remain in court before Judge Daigle, who had approved the settlement in Zawakowski. And indeed, the defendants had obtained an injunction from Judge Daigle enjoining anyone from proceeding with any other cases in any other forums other than the judicial forum that they selected there. What's particularly notable about those choices is the defendant did this after they had convinced Judge Daigle to compel arbitration, at least as regards to the Block defendant. So they had prevailed on a motion to compel arbitration, gotten themselves dismissed from the case, and then when they had the opportunity to enter into a settlement that presumably they regarded as favorable, they decided to come back into court. They even helped draft the RICO complaint against themselves that was ultimately the basis of the class action settlement. And they not only came back into court, but they invited everybody that ever entered into any refund anticipation loan agreement to come into court with them. And we contend that by making that choice, by choosing a judicial forum in order to...
In what way could it ever be said that a defendant chooses a judicial forum? You filed this lawsuit in federal court. The defendant moved for arbitration at the earliest possible opportunity, and then you sought to consolidate this with Judge Zagel's case. In what way does one say that defendants initiated this litigation?
The defendants were the ones that wanted to include us in the Judge Daigle case. We, pursuant to the class action settlement, they were the ones that participated in the joint motion to approve the class action settlement and to bring all these claims into that forum for resolution in the form of a settlement. A class action settlement is a judicial event in addition to being a contractual
one. We do agree
one.
That you are the plaintiff and not the defendant, right?
Yeah, of course.
The reason we are in federal court is that you filed a lawsuit, right?
Correct.
I was thinking from your argument that you were the defendant.
No. I'm. We filed our own lawsuit, but
right.
They selected a forum.
I don't understand where this argument is going. Is there any doubt that the defendants moved for arbitration at their very first opportunity in this lawsuit?
It depends on... They did move for arbitration, and then they abandoned that motion.
And you opposed it, right? You opposed that motion.
We never actually got to the briefing. They filed the motion twice. First they filed the motion, then they abandoned the motion in favor of saying that we were included in the settlement. Then we battled over that for 2 years, and so before the case had come to this court on the issue of the settlement, we had never had the opportunity to oppose the motion that they filed when the case was first assigned to Judge Nordberg. Instead, we were trying to extricate ourselves from the settlement. So yes, they did file the motion, but then they didn't proceed on it. Instead, they chose to abandon it in favor of saying that we should be included in the class action settlement that was before Judge Daigle. And by making that choice, we contend they waived their right to come back and reassert their motion after they basically lost on appeal. Had this court not reversed Judge Daigle's settlement as unfair, then the defendants would have been contented. They would have achieved exactly what they wanted, a judicial resolution of their claim for $25 to each class member that did not opt out. So they gambled in the hopes that they would be able to get through the settlement, the $25 settlement. When that gamble didn't pay off, then they came back and they asked for what is, I guess, their second best alternative, which was arbitration. But it certainly wasn't the preferred alternative, or they would have been contending for arbitration all along.
Could you have opted for arbitration somewhere along the line?
Presumably we could have, yes. And as a matter of fact, I would assume that we could have opposed the inclusion in the Judge Daigle settlement on the grounds that we were subject to arbitration, but then we would obviously be consenting to arbitration and that we...
But we, you did have that alternative.
Our choice at that point would be either to arbitrate our claims, which we don't contend is what we wanted to do, or agree to the $25. That's correct. That was, as we say in our brief, heads I win, tails you lose, because the defendant basically gets what they want, or they're one of their top two preferred alternatives under any scenario. And our ability to pursue our claims in court would not occur if we opted for arbitration. And there are a lot of reasons we chose not to opt for arbitration, particularly with the particular ARB forum involved, the National Arbitration Forum, and there are issues concerning costs, and we believe bias, issues that we were not allowed discovery on, which we also contend is one of the errors that the district court made, is that in order to meet our burden and show that an arbitration clause is unconscionable, we would, for instance, we wanted to argue the forum was biased. Because, for instance, some studies have shown that NAF decided for the creditor in 99.6% of the cases. That was the Toppings case out of Maryland, and had actually marketed itself to entities saying that the use of the NAF as an arbitral forum was the answer to the multi-million-dollar class action lawsuit. So we didn't get to explore those issues of bias. Nor did we get to explore the issues of how much it would have cost us, because the NAF offers kind of an a la carte menu, is you have to pay for any subpoenas or pay for any depositions you want to do. So in terms of what it would have cost us, we were not able to put that evidence before the district court, even though we asked for the opportunity to present
it. Actually, it sounds like you're describing one of the benefits of arbitration. Arbitration doesn't make very much sense if the only way to arbitrate is first to litigate. Right? It can't possibly be a money-saving device if the first step in every arbitration is litigation about the arbitration. Can it? I mean, why should the district court entertain any such claims?
Well, first of all, I would contend that it's the defendant that chose to spend a lot of money litigating, because for 2 years we were embroiled in litigation over whether we were in the Judge Daigle settlement. So to the extent that efficiency in terms of saving money was a concern, that ship has sailed when defendant forced us to fight for 2 years. The other...
I thought you said you could go into arbitration if you wanted to.
We presumably could have elected...
Presumably, no, you could. You just didn't want to. I mean, I understand why you didn't want to, but that's still not... I mean, that you were frozen out of going into arbitration.
Well,
by a 2-year delay.
And particularly in this case, because according to the arbitration clause, we cannot receive punitive damages in arbitration or statutory damages, which are our key components of our claims under the federal statutes that award statutory damages. This particular arbitration clause, in particular, because of the remedy stripping provisions.
This is another thing I don't understand. What forum the case is heard in is distinct from what remedies are available. That was part of the point of Pacificare against Book, right? You can be in an arbitral forum and have more remedies, or you could be in a judicial forum and have fewer remedies. The fact that the contract provides for fewer remedies doesn't have anything to do with the choice of forum, does it?
Well, if the remedy...
It tells you what person you have to argue your remedies question to, the arbitrator rather than a court.
In Book and Basil and Howsam, all three of those cases decided by the Supreme Court, there was no dispute that there was a valid arbitration clause. They all involved issues concerning the scope of the clause or the remedies.
One of the parties in each of the clauses was denying that it was required to arbitrate. That's why those cases went to the Supreme Court.
the parties were denying that they were required to arbitrate particular claims or to seek particular forms of relief, but there was no challenge in any of those claims to the actual validity of the clause. Here we claim that the clause is not valid, and we're entitled to a judicial determination on the validity of the clause. And we claim that the clause is not valid because of its remedy stripping, which makes it substantively and procedurally unconscionable.
That's the very argument that the Supreme Court said in Book has to go to the arbitrator. I mean, you're asking us to disagree with the Supreme Court. It's not something we are allowed to do.
I understand. I think that Book is...
Well, we don't do lightly anyway.
I think Book is distinguishable because there was no serious contention that the arbitration clause was unenforceable. The question was whether or not...
That's what the Court of Appeals held in Book, that the arbitration clause was unenforceable.
On the
and
issue
that's
of,
what the Supreme Court reversed.
Well, the Supreme Court, as I recall, said that treble damages under RICO are compensatory, not punitive, and so whether or not the arbitration clause stripped out punitive remedies was not a question that they were going to reach. Although I see that I'm in rebuttal time, and I'd like to reserve the balance of my time unless the panel has any further questions.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Ms. Stone.
Good morning to the panel. I'd like to clarify a few points that Mr. Langone mentioned in his argument. Mr. Langone made a statement that in connection with the case below in front of Judge Nordberg that the defendant abandoned the rights to arbitrate and suggested he had no opportunity to respond to those pending motions, and that is not the case. I think if we take a look at Judge Nordberg's opinion and indeed the undisputed facts, it is the plaintiff, Mr. Langone, that repeatedly came to the court to ask for time to respond to the pending motions. We didn't delay a decision on the arbitration ruling. We did not ask to delay that issue from being resolved by Judge Nordberg. It was the plaintiff. And that motion stood unresponded to for 10 months until the plaintiff ultimately dismissed the case without prejudice pending the appeal in Filikowski. So with deference to Mr. Langone, we at no point abandoned our arbitration rights, either below or in front of Filikowski for that matter. And that really goes, I think, ultimately to the question that this court needs to address, which is whether under the totality of the circumstances here, there was really any election by this defendant, by these defendants, to proceed in a judicial forum. And I think the answer is not. There is nothing to suggest that we were acting so inconsistently with the right to arbitrate that it can be deemed that we were abandoning our rights to have the arbitration heard on the merits. Plaintiff refers to this court's opinion in Grumhouse, in Cabinetry, for the proposition that because you have substantially participated in the litigation, that could be deemed an implied waiver by conduct. But respectfully, in all of those cases, nothing remotely occurred in those cases that occurred in this case and vice versa. In Grumhouse, in St. Mary's, in Cabinetry, all the cases plaintiff relies upon, there was substantial participation by the party who was seeking arbitration. In one case, it was the plaintiff who had actually filed suit in federal court. That was deemed an election, a choice to proceed in a judicial forum and abandon your arbitration rights. That didn't happen here. In Cabinetry, the defendant had engaged in discovery, had been involved in depositions, documents, had filed motions for summary judgment, trial dates had been set, the same in Grumhouse. None of those things occurred in front of Judge Nordberg. And in fact, the plaintiffs here don't even suggest there was any conduct by the defendants in front of Judge Nordberg that remotely rose to the level of a waiver of our arbitration rights. What they assert is instead that in connection with Filikowski, by seeking to have a broad settlement, that somehow was an election of a judicial remedy because we were trying to settle a case. But that is not the holdings, in my, as we read them, of either St. Mary's, of Grumhouse, or Cabinetry. It's talking about attempts to seek an adjudication on a merits basis, where you're seeking a motion to dismiss, where you're trying to get a court ruling on an issue before you decide whether to opt in or opt out for arbitration. That never happened here. And Dickinson and, I think, Walker are instructive on the point. I think Dickinson and Walker both talk about the salutary purposes behind the settlement, and we should not be placed in a position of having to choose between trying to settle a case on a broad basis, certainly, or between our rights to have arbitration. I think that also Judge Bucklow had it correct. Judge Bucklow, as you recall, received the Zolkowski case back on remand. And Judge Bucklow was faced basically with the same issues in the case now known as Carnegie, which we sent to supplemental authority. The plaintiffs in that case, the Zolkowski settlement plaintiffs, they raised exactly the same issue, saying, in that case, in Zolkowski, you have waived rights to arbitration because you sponsored and supported a settlement. And Judge Bucklow rejected that argument as well. So while Judge Bucklow and Judge Nordberg were coming at it from slightly different perspectives, they were basically looking at the same set of facts. When we turn to the question of unconscionability, Judge Nordberg answered the question of who decides whether the clause is unconscionable by answering, in this case, it's the arbitrator. Now, Judge Nordberg got to that answer in a slightly different way than we had advocated either below or before this court, but he got the answer correct. And the answer is that I think you start your analysis here initially with first options. I think that the first options court, the Supreme Court holding in first options, clearly dictates that questions of arbitrability, gateway matters, can be assigned validly to the arbitrator as long as there's clear and compelling evidence that that was the party's intent. And here, we in fact have a clause that specifically says issues of validity and enforceability are for the arbitrator to decide. It's not ambiguous. And while the plaintiff argues in their reply brief that you distinguish first options because that goes to the scope of arbitrability, in fact, first options goes to the question of arbitrability. And the Supreme Court, I believe, in both Housam and Basel, both indicate that questions of arbitrability, that type of thing that first options found can be validly assigned to the arbitrator, includes gateway matters such as enforceability. You get there, again, in a separate way. You get there because, as is indicated by the Supreme Court in Pacific Care, principally the challenges here to unconscionability all go to remedies, class action, statute of limitations, fee issues. Those are all remedy issues that I believe are appropriately decided in the first instance by the arbitrator. Housam and Hawkins, Boomer, Pacific Care all indicate as much. And if you decided to take a look, which we don't think you get there because we do think those issues are for the arbitrator in the first instance, the elements that purport to comprise the unconscionability here are not that at all. The plaintiff has advocated a view that you take a clause, such as an arbitration clause, and look at it in a gestalt fashion. That is, the whole can be greater than the sum of the parts. But respectfully, when none of the elements are unconscionable, 5 times 0 will always still equal 0. And the elements they challenge, the challenges to the remedies here, are not unconscionable. Class action, the lack of a class action availability, this court has repeatedly found, does not render a clause unconscionable. The statute of limitations issue does not render the clause unconscionable. Indeed, as Housam indicated, it is something for the arbitrator to decide in the first instance. And the fact is that the statute of limitations question, whether it's in an arbitrable forum or it's in a court proceeding, are going to be guided by effectively the same rules. The NFA rule that the plaintiff cites is an incomplete citation, as we indicate in our brief. When you look at the totality, it permits tolling just like the federal courts do. So if he's lost the statute of limitations, it's not because he's going to be in an arbitration. And unconscionability, in any event, that has to be looked at the time of contract formation. And at the time of contract formation, one could not be predictive about whether the plaintiff would be missing or allowing a statute of limitations to lapse. The last issue that I want to address on unconscionability is the fee-shifting matter. And I think we have addressed it adequately in our brief. I would answer any questions about it other than to suggest that I do think it is for the arbitrator in the first instance.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Anything further, Mr. Langone?
Yeah,
on the question of arbitrability, it's not disputed that that question is for the court to decide in the first instance. For a clause to be arbitrable, it must be valid and it must be enforceable. We contend that it is not arbitrability that, that does not meet that standard here because it's not enforceable, it was waived. And so because defendants waive their right to arbitrate, they don't have a valid and enforceable arbitration clause, and it's not valid because it's unconscionable. Now, the Supreme Court did say that on these gateway questions that the court is to decide those in the first instance unless the contracting parties would likely, I'll just quote, this is from the Book opinion, indeed we have found the phrase question of arbitrability applicable in the narrow circumstance where contracting parties would have likely expected a court to have decided a gateway matter and where they are not likely to have thought they would have agreed that an arbitrator would do so, and consequently where the reference to the gateway dispute to the court avoids the risk of forcing parties to arbitrate a matter that they might not well have agreed to arbitrate. I don't think the fact that the defendant puts one clause in a boilerplate contract full of legalese that says that, you know, issues of validity and enforceability are for the arbitrator is the kind of circumstance that the Supreme Court talked about.
It is, however, exactly what the Supreme Court said in the first options could be done, is it not? The court says if you want these issues resolved by the arbitrator, put in this clause. They put in that clause.
Well, the clause
why doesn't
it
have the consequence the Supreme Court described?
The clause was not negotiated, the clause was not salient, the clause would not be understandable to a majority of consumers.
This whole business that unless you negotiate clause by clause, it doesn't count, is something right out of the 60s, and I thought it was gone a long time ago. The Supreme Court said in Laurel Lines against Chasser that it didn't was not a valid argument in federal court. Why should we entertain it here?
Well, I'm not saying that it has to be, every clause has to be negotiated, but these issues of, that's why in our brief we talk more in terms of salience and talk about how it's unreasonable to expect that certainly you can have form contracts that are adhesive so long as the terms are salient to a substantial majority of consumers, then people will have the opportunity.
I just don't understand this. The contract in Chasser was one printed in really tiny type on the back of a cruise ship ticket, and it said everything will be litigated in Florida. And the Supreme Court held that the fact that it was in really tiny type and legalese and on a form and not negotiated did not prevent its enforcement. Now that's a forum selection clause. This is a forum selection clause. What's the difference?
This is a forum selection clause that substantively strips remedies. And it essentially begs the question because it's part of, we're saying, basically it's part of the clause is you agree to let the arbitrator decide disputes. But if there's no agreement to arbitrate, then there is no arbitrator that can be conjured into existence. I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will take a brief recess before the second case.